Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the third class in the Discovering Buddhism module on refuge. Anyone here for the first time tonight? Okay, great. Glad to have you here. We'll begin with some meditation. So I think everyone's familiar with the posture now. I'm not going to have to describe that in any great detail. Phone's off. It happens every week, don't worry. Okay, so begin by checking your posture, just doing a scan, working down from the top of your head, looking for any sources of tension or discomfort and address them now. The point of the posture being that it's stable and self-maintaining. You don't have to put a lot of effort. It shouldn't be uncomfortable or painful. And having established the posture, we'll begin with some 9-round breathing, and there are lots of different versions. Geshe Gelug did one version Sunday morning that's a little bit different from what I do. That's fine. But they're all just to stabilize the breath and to get the mind to settle, not to space out or go blank, but to leave aside some of the distractions and become more concentrated and more focused. And the breathing actually has an effect like that on the mind. So as we do the 9-round breathing, we have the stomach expand on the in-breath so that our diaphragm is pulled down and the lungs are completely filled. Then on the exhalation, the stomach contracts back into the spinal column. So we close our left nostril with our right index finger and take 3 breaths in and out through the right nostril. And we close the right nostril, 3 breaths, in and out through the left nostril. And then 3 breaths in and out through both nostrils. And now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And we begin our meditation by setting our motivation. And as much as possible, we generate the bodhicitta motivation, the great mind meditation, that even something as simple as sitting on a cushion, paying attention to our breath, developing a little bit of concentration. We're doing that to improve our mind so that we can benefit all living beings. Even a very simple action like this, we kind of superpower it with that motivation. And having set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation. The chosen object for the meditation is the breath. The physical sensation of breath moving in and out through our nostrils. A very neutral object. Not virtuous in and of itself. But we just place our mind, our awareness, our concentration on the breath, directly experiencing it without interpretation or projection or telling a story about it. Just mind directly perceiving breath moving in and out. And inevitably we'll notice at some point that our mind is not on the breath. It's on something else. Something that happened, something that is going to happen, or just some fantasy. And we just set that aside and direct the mind back to the breath. It's as if a child has wandered off the path in the woods, and we go back and gently take the child by the hand and bring it back to the path. That's what we're doing with our mind over and over. That quality of mind that realizes when we're off the path is called awareness. We become aware that we're off the chosen object and we come back to it. So as often as we need to, we do that over and over again, placing the mind on the breath. And we can end our meditation with a dedication. Acknowledge to ourselves that we've created some positive energy, a positive imprint on our mind stream. And we think, we aspire that that positive imprint will ripen in a way that benefits all sentient beings. Any questions or comments about that meditation? Okay. I think everybody's a pretty experienced meditator by this point. Everybody seemed quite quiet and still. I didn't hear anyone fall off their cushion. Just to review a little bit, so we're all at the same place. What's refuge? Anybody want to give me a definition of refuge? Shelter, okay. What else?
Reliable,
okay, yeah. A shelter that's reliable, a safe place. In Buddhism, we're always talking about the path to enlightenment, so we can think that this is the path. This is the entryway to the path. So we say we're taking refuge, and we take refuge in the Buddha, okay. The Dharma, and Greg, right? No. And what's the third one? Sangha. I don't know why that came into my mind. Yeah. Buddha, the historical figure, the human being who lived 2,500 years ago, who achieved enlightenment by working with his own mind. The Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, and the Sangha, the others that are on a similar path. Okay, so not that we see the Buddha as a god, but this is, we see these as the representations of the way we want to go. When things are getting tough or when things are getting good, this is what we turn to. An acknowledgement that this is the path that we're going to follow. So what are the causes of going for refuge? Yes, fear. Or dread. And what do I mean by that? What are we afraid of? That we're afraid of the consequences of our actions. That they will continue to cause us to suffer. Because in Buddhism, we believe that everything that we experience, everything, both pleasant and unpleasant, but we tend to concentrate more on the suffering because that's what we want to get rid of, it's a result of past actions of body, speech, and mind. That's the law, if you want to use that word, of karma, which is the Buddhist description of the way things work. So we are fearful, or we are dreading, the results of our actions unless we make some sort of change. Okay, we want to be free of suffering. As Holiness the Dalai Lama always says that. We all want to be free of suffering, and that's a completely valid aspiration. It's not selfish at all, okay, to want to be free of suffering, because that's just that's something that's common to all of us. So it's the fear of continuing to suffer, the fear that of the consequences of our actions that motivates us to look for a different way of living our lives. So the first cause is fear or dread. The second one is, somebody said it earlier, confidence. And what does that mean? Yeah, that we have looked at the objects of refuge, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and found them to be reliable. It's like I use the example of we're out in the field in the middle of a terrible thunderstorm, and we know that there's a barn on the other side of the hill. We can't see it right now, but we've seen it before. We've looked at it. We've seen it doesn't have a big metal roof on it. We are confident that that is a safe place to go, so we head in that direction. Okay? And similarly, we've looked at the Buddha. We've looked at the Dharma. We've looked at the Sangha. We've analyzed them over and over again, and we are confident that they are valid objects of refuge. In some ways, this is similar to, you could say, faith, but not blind faith. And just as a little diversion here, there's they describe three types of faith in Buddhism. Okay, I'll just give you this. The first one is called convicted faith, which is the result of analysis and reason, okay, that you are confident that these are valid objects of refuge because you've looked at them, you've analyzed them, you've tested them against your own experience. The second type is what's called aspiring faith, where you know their qualities and you wish to have those qualities for yourself. Okay, you aspire to be like the Buddha, to understand the Dharma, to be like the other people in the Sangha. That's aspiration. And then the third type they refer to is what they call admiring faith, which means that it's just a very pleasurable experience to think about them. You're so completely convinced of their good qualities that just thinking about them gives you a little kind of sense of joy or pleasure. You're so clear about their good qualities. So three types of faith, none of which are blind faith. The Buddha says, do not take anything just because I am saying it. That is absolutely the wrong way to approach my teachings, according to the Buddha. And then in the Mahayana tradition, the tradition that Tibetan Buddhism is part of, these are the two classic causes of going for refuge. There's a third one. Does anybody remember what that is? Compassion, okay? What's the word compassion mean in Buddhism? Yeah. Or actually, you can have compassion for yourself also. So it's the wish that beings not suffer, yeah. We've looked at these. We've seen this as the path we want to follow. We see that it's a path that leads to the end of suffering for ourselves and others. So we take refuge out of compassion for ourselves to end our suffering, and also because we're aware of the suffering of others. And we see that this is the best way that we can benefit others. They say in Buddhism, the best thing you can do for others is first get your own act together. If you see someone else who is in the pond drowning and you don't know how to swim, it's not going to do you any good to jump in the pond. Okay, so what we're learning, the greatest gift we can give to others is to get our act together. So out of compassion, the wish that others not be free of suffering, we take refuge. Okay? Three causes of going for refuge. Everybody clear on that? Any questions or comments? Okay, and let's see, okay, so that's the material that we've covered so far, and like I say, refuge is not something, well, we talk about refuge in two ways. One, it's a continual state. It's something that we're always going for refuge as long as we're on the path. And there's also the specific refuge ceremony that we take one time and is our formal entrance into the path. And I think a lot of us in the West tend to think of it as our Buddhist confirmation or something like that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the whole idea of vows and the refuge ceremony tonight. How many people here have gone through a formal refuge ceremony? Okay, quite a few. So everybody knows their refuge commitments. We'll get to that. Okay. But first I wanted to talk about the general subject of vows, because this comes up in a lot in Buddhism. What's the definition of a vow? What's a vow? A promise. Okay. What else? A commitment. Okay. That's another good word. What do you hear when you think the word vow? Does that sound something good or something not good? What?
Weddings,
yeah. People think of their weddings they've been through, yeah, their wedding vows. What else do you think of? I mean, is it a word that makes you feel happy, or does it feel kind of oppressive, or? Serious, okay. What else? A commitment. And what does a commitment feel like? Does that feel good or does that feel bad? An obligation. Okay. Something that's what? Limiting? It limits you, but the reasons that it limits you makes a big difference. Okay. Beginning of a journey. Focus. Okay. Yeah. In Buddhism, vows tend to be things that we're not going to do. So say, I am not going to do this. I am not going to do that. If this opportunity comes up, I will not avoid doing this. Sometimes they're like that. But they tend to be in the sense of negatives, things I'm not going to do. They're putting limits on our behavior. We voluntarily are saying, I know for me it works better if I don't do X, Y, and Z. It's a way of protecting ourselves. It's a way of, protecting ourselves in a way. And it's just a way of making our innate knowledge about what works and what doesn't work a little bit more formal. Okay. If we have some understanding of karma, we know that if we have the opportunity to, say, we have the opportunity to kill arises. Say we see a cockroach scurrying across the kitchen floor when we get home from the Kadampa Center tonight and we flip the lights on. The opportunity to kill the cockroach presents itself. We don't kill the cockroach. We've created some good karma there. If we've taken a vow not to kill, the Buddha says, We are creating the good karma of not killing continuously, even if the opportunity doesn't present itself. Even while we're asleep, we're creating the good karma of not killing by virtue of having taken the vow. I can't explain that, but that's what the Buddha says. But when we go through a formal taking a vow, we are continually creating the good karma of not performing that negative action. Whereas without the vow, the good karma is just when the opportunity arises and we don't do it. So that's very powerful. I cannot give you any explanation of that, but that's what the Buddha says. Don't take it on faith. Think about it. See if it makes sense. But it's something about the power of putting a vow, of taking a vow, makes such a strong, if you do it seriously, and try to keep the vow, somehow it makes such a positive, strong imprint on your mind stream that it has that very strong effect. We take... Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, continual, perpetual. We take the vows in Tibetan Buddhism, or in Buddhism, fully aware that we're going to break them. Okay? We are aware that we cannot keep them perfectly, but it is still better to take a vow, attempt to keep it, and even if you break it, then to not have taken it at all. Of course, if it's something that you know you have no chance of keeping even for a day, don't take that vow. Don't be cynical about it. But if you're making a sincere attempt to keep the vow, Even if you break it, you're creating good karma for yourself. And a broken vow can always be repaired, as they say. And there are various ways of doing that. Okay. There are three main levels of vows in the Tibetan tradition. Does anybody know what those are by chance? You got some of the right words in there. You're kind of jumbling them up, okay? There's what's called the Pratimoksha vows. And I'll explain what this means. Pratimoksha. There are the Bodhisattva vows. And then there are the Tantric vows. This is very interesting, and I cannot explain this. The Pratimoksha vows and the Tantric vows you have to take from a qualified master whom you can trace the lineage all the way back to the historical Buddha. The Bodhisattva vows you can take by yourself. You can just read them and take them. I hadn't realized that. I've always taken them from somebody. Okay, but that's interesting. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Does anybody know what Pratimoksha means? These are individual liberation. Oops, I can't spell. These are the vows of individual liberation. Liberation from what? From suffering, yeah. Liberation from samsara, from personal suffering. These are vows that, if you follow them completely, will end your personal suffering. So liberation from suffering. How do we end our personal, what's the easiest, or the way we end our personal suffering? What's the cause of no suffering? No, you're jumping ahead of it, yeah. Practicing ethics, not harming, okay? Practicing ethics, which in Buddhism means not harming. If we live ethically, that is the way to end our personal suffering, okay? As Venerable Rabina says, zip your lips and keep your hands to yourself. That's the Pratimoksha vows. These are about things we do not do. We vow not to do. So under this, we will find the five lay. There'll be the lay vows, which are also referred to as the. Sometimes you'll see the word householder vows. These are vows for people who haven't taken robes. And all the vows of monks and nuns are the other category of Pratimoksha vows, from novice all the way up to fully ordained. Those are their version of the Pratimoksha vows, the vows of personal liberation. Okay? And there are various levels of this, and I'm not an expert on it. And there are hundreds of them, and for some reason the nuns have more vows than the monks, and you're not told what they are before you take robes either. They kind of lay it on you, yeah. This is why some of our Sangha members can't eat after noon. They'll only have their big meal. But there are different levels in their vows. So we can't really talk about those because I don't know what they are. But they are Pratimoksha vows also. Okay? So the lay vows are, how many of them are there? Five, okay. And they are, I'll just put no killing. What else? Steely. Uh-huh. Lying, sexual misconduct. And what else? Or no intoxicants. Or exactly, okay. Or what we could say recreational drugs. No recreational drugs. These are the four root ones. You avoid intoxicants because they cause you to perform the other ones. Yeah, there's a story about a monk was alone with a goat, a female, and a bottle of alcohol. And so what happened was he drank the alcohol, he killed the goat, and he raped the woman. But that's the way they think about intoxicants. They cause you to break the other vows. Okay. So the question always comes up, if I'm going to take these vows, do I have to take all of them? And you'll hear different answers on this, but I went to some really reliable sources, and they said, you do not have to take all of them. If you are in a ceremony where you're taking the lay vows, you decide to yourself, you don't tell the teacher, the person you're taking the vows from, which ones you're going to take. And it's all perfectly acceptable just to take one, or to take four, or to take all five. You can't half take one. You can't say, I'm going to drink wine, but I'm not going to drink beer or whiskey. You know, you have to, or I'm going to not drink alcohol, but I'm going to smoke pot. You know, you have to take the vow completely. But it is a personal decision which ones you're going to take if you're taking these vows. You can give up one of these vows if you've taken one and you feel like it is just not possible in your life right now. You can say to yourself, okay, I'm giving up that vow. You don't have to tell the teacher who you're taking the vows from. This is a personal decision. You sit there on your cushion during the ceremony, which is quite simple, and you decide which ones you're taking, which ones you're not. That's a personal decision. But they have to be taken from a qualified teacher who can trace his teacher, back to his teacher, back to her teacher, back to her teacher, back to his teacher, all the way back to the historical Buddha. The lineage, you are receiving the uninterrupted lineage of those vows. And that's what makes them valid. And that's why there's some controversies in the monks and nuns' vows about whether the lineage has died out or not. It's a little bit controversial, particularly with the nuns, or which Buddhist traditions the lineage has continued in. But that's something I am not qualified to talk about. Okay, so those are the Pratimoksha vows, taken from a qualified teacher with the lineage. The Bodhisattva vows, as I said, and I didn't really know this, you can take on your own. But most people do take them from a teacher. But this does not require taking them from a teacher with the lineage. The Bodhisattva vows, are what are they about? Bodhicitta, which is the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others. So this is the compassion side, okay? These are about developing compassion. This is really about developing wisdom here. Knowledge of reality. These are about developing compassion. Does anybody know how many Bodhisattva vows there are? There are the root vows and then the secondary vows. I forget how many it adds up to. It adds up to 30-something. And they're quite complicated. And inevitably, you will break some of them. And you can retake them and repair them. Tantric vows have to be taken from a qualified teacher. They're taken during an initiation, which means, or an empowerment, where the permission to do the tantric meditation is given to you by a qualified practitioner. These vows are basically about removing the most subtle karmic hindrances to complete enlightenment. They're about, and these, like the monk and nun vows, you can't study before you take them. You go into an initiation and you don't know what you're going to get laid on you. There are certain vows that are common to each initiation, but then there are always other things that are given with it. So again, you're going in, and you can be blindsided to some degree. Yeah. It'll be different from which teacher you're getting them from, which tantric empowerment you're taking. There's going to be a lot of variability. This is why it's not why some people go around and take tantric initiations right and left, and they don't even know what vows they're taking. Because, well, if you're in a tantric empowerment, you'll take the pratimoksha vows and the bodhisattva vows as part of the initiation. Those are always included. But if anybody's been to like the Kala Chakra or something, it's so complicated. You're sitting there, you don't know what's going on. You don't know if you're getting the empowerment or not. And it's so it's really something I'm not qualified to talk about, but that'll be talked about more in the class on Tantra, which is the end of the course. The most subtle karmic hindrances to complete enlightenment. The pratimoksha vows and the bodhisattva vows, you can study before you take them. They're out there everywhere, and it's very appropriate to study them before you take them. You shouldn't jump in and take them right away. You should study them and think about what they mean and see if this is a possibility. The bodhisattva vows, you have to take all of them. You can't. There's no picking and choosing. The pratimoksha vows, and again, this question comes over, but I went to some really super reliable sources, and they all said you can pick and choose. That's your decision. You don't have to discuss it with the teacher that you're taking the vows from. It's something you say to yourself silently during the ceremony. Yeah. The best way is just to go through the ceremony again. Yeah. Yeah, you can just set that aside on your own. You don't have to go to a ceremony or anything like that. But repairing means you know you've broken one over and over, but you want to keep the vow. Okay, so you kind of have to, you're refreshing it. I mean, you can just do that mentally by just thinking about it. Sitting in on a ceremony is good. Sometimes they give you specific practices on how to repair vows, but that's more than I'm qualified to talk about it. The best thing would be to ask a teacher, what can I do? I've broken this vow. I don't want to give it up. Okay? But what can I do to repair it? Oh. Same thing. Yeah, bodhisattva vows are much more difficult to keep. They're much more complicated.
But if you give, let's say, break one of those, are all of the others then broken?
That's a good question. And, yeah. That's a good question. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, these, if you break one, you've just broken that one. You haven't broken the others. So I assume it would be similar for the bodhisattva vows. I know the root vows are those are the ones you really want to avoid breaking if at all possible. Those are the ones that it's very much harder to repair if you've broken them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's less of a problem to repair than if you kill a human or something bad like that, then it's at the root.
There's all sorts of things like that, and again, I'm not qualified to talk about that. Okay. Yeah. Vajrasattva practice can repair, is a good way to repair broken vows. If you do it for the specific purpose of repairing broken vows, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? How are we doing on time here? Okay. So, what does all this have to do with refuge? Let's see. I'm going to erase this. We've talked about what refuge is, and then we're also talking about the actual refuge ceremony, which is a formal ceremony you go through. It's quite simple, actually. You're given in this tradition, you're given a Tibetan name. That's one of the traditions that go with it. I'm not quite sure of the significance of that. And basically the ceremony, it really doesn't last very long. It's like 10 or 15 minutes usually. It's just saying I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Saying that three times in the presence of a qualified teacher. And that's the refuge ceremony. The Pratimoksha vows are usually included in the refuge ceremony. And lots of times people talk about refuge vows that they take, but the more proper way to talk about it is the refuge commitments. In that when you take refuge from a qualified teacher, again, in this, You should check the teacher out, okay? Don't just take refuge with the first teacher that comes through. Take it from someone that you really admire and respect. You're not taking refuge in that teacher, though, okay? You're taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. This does not get into the whole thing of seeing the teacher as the Buddha. That's farther along the path. So it should be someone that you respect and admire, but it doesn't necessarily have to be your main teacher or your root guru. Okay? Refuge is a ceremony you go through one time. You can sit in on refuge ceremonies after you've done it. That's fine. But you're only taking refuge one time. It's with the understanding that it's a lifetime commitment to that path. The Pratimoksha and Bodhisattva vows, you can take those over and over again and actually go through the ceremony and take the vows. So the refuge ceremony comes with certain commitments. And we have a guest teacher who is going to talk to us about the refuge commitments. Yeah. Because you will find different versions of the refuge commitments. It's not a clear subject at all. So. Uh-huh. How many are you going to tell us? Okay. Let's see, rely, second one is?
Oh, you want it like that, rely?
Yeah.
Second one is to maintain loving thoughts.
Okay. First is reliance. Second is altruistic thoughts. I'll just repeat what she says. Okay. Okay. Third. Okay. Offerings. Third one is offerings. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Stay cool.
Yeah, stay cool.
Well, you can be happy.
I always felt it all before.
But a little bit of equanimity is appreciated, yes. Okay. Let's see. Well, there's another one, yeah. There's another one. Again, sometimes you'll see six, sometimes you'll see four, and then they say you're supposed to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha three times in the morning, three times in the evening. Okay? Or three times, take refuge three times each day and three times each night. Which just means saying, I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha three times in the morning and three times at the end of the day. That's why when we do the prayers, we always repeat the refuge prayer three times. So that's one way of doing. Yeah. So the first one is relying on the holy beings or the objects of refuge. Second one is having altruistic thoughts. Third is making offerings, which just means when you sit down, when you start a meal or have something hot to drink, mentally offer some of it to the objects of refuge, to the three jewels. You don't actually have to take something and putting it on an altar. You don't have to say anything out loud if you're in a restaurant. If you're with other Buddhists, you can say some Buddhist prayers. But if you're dining with other people, just mentally offer part of the meal to the objects of refuge. Fourth one is not to just turn into a vegetable or anything, but avoid extremes. Yeah. Be a little bit of, do you know what the word for Buddhist in Tibetan is? What do Tibetans call Buddhists? Yeah, there is no word for a Buddhist in Tibetan. I forget what the word is, but it means inner being. Okay? Which you're an inner being. So you want to act like the way an inner being would act, which doesn't mean you can't laugh or enjoy things at all. Yeah. And then remember to take refuge three times in the morning, three times in the evening. So those are the commitments. And people, sometimes when you take refuge, they're not explained well, so people kind of get confused about them. But those are the main things. Questions or comments? Okay. So
you don't want to offer junk, but you can transform it. Your mind can imagine that it's the most precious. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, do you ever come to the pujas here? I mean, there's a lot of junk food in the pujas. The object is more to get stuff that's colorful and visually attractive rather than stuff that's healthy for you or good for you. Because you transform it into...
Just take a little taste.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, the refuge ceremony comes with commitments, and typically the Pratimoksha vows will be part of the ceremony. So the Pratimoksha vows being things that you are not going to do, the commitments being things that you are going to do. And if you go through a refuge ceremony, you choose which of the Pratimoksha vows you're going to take. The refuge commitments, you don't have a choice. You have to take them all. Pratimoksha vows, refuge commitments, and bodhisattva vows, you can study before you take them. You should study them before you take them and look at them. Tantric vows, you cannot study. And ordained vows, you can't study. Pratimoksha vows, refuge, tantric vows have to be taken from a teacher with an unbroken lineage. Bodhisattva vows, apparently, you can just take them on your own, but generally you take them from a teacher. Pratimoksha vows, bodhisattva vows, tantric vows, you can take over and over. Refuge ceremony, you only actively participate in at one time with the understanding it's a lifetime commitment. Okay. Yeah. Refuge is always included in a tantric empowerment for those people who haven't taken it. Apparently, there are some people who go to tantric empowerments who have never taken anything, so it's always included, which is kind of weird. So the implication is that you would have to take refuge for the tantric vows at least. I mean, it makes sense that you would have to. I never heard anyone say that you absolutely have to. But that's a good question, but I can't answer it. Yeah. You're asking if you had to take refuge before taking the vows, correct? Yeah, I can't answer that.
But they actually said, I read in a couple different sources, that you can take refuge. I'm not going to go there, yeah. Because I'm kind of confused, so I'm not going to bring that up. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. Tantric empowerment, okay. Tantra is a class, a whole category of meditations where you meditate on some of these tantric deities that you see around here. To do that meditation, you have to take an empowerment from a qualified teacher, which theoretically gives you permission to do that meditation. And it can be something that you do one-on-one with the teacher, or it can be something like when His Holiness does the Kaya Chakra, and there are 10,000 people in the auditorium taking the empowerment. But it's a ceremony that typically lasts a couple days that you go through. And at some point, all of this is going to be included in it. But it's very... Who here has gone to a Kala Chakra? Anybody gone to Kala Chakra? I mean, they're open to the public, you know. Tantra is not secret the way it used to be to some degree. At some point, all of these vows will be included in it, but it's such a confusing ceremony that you may just miss it completely. And you come out of there and everybody's saying, what do we commit to? What do we have to do? You know, generally when they give it in a big public, setting like that, it's something like, you know, say this mantra 20 times a day. You know, it's not go off and do a 5-year retreat or something, but things like that have been known to have happened. But usually the tantric vows are also about how you relate to other people who have taken that empowerment with you and how you see your environment. And they're going to be different with each tantric meditation that you take an empowerment for. Okay? Yeah.
This may be beyond the scope of say. Tantric vows during a ceremony, if you see what the vows are,
before you commit? No. No. The vows and the commitments you don't know before you go in. The vows parts tend to be somewhat similar from one empowerment to the next. The commitments can be completely variable based on the meditation and based on who's giving the empowerment.
Once you enter that, you're going to do it.
You're taking a vow, yeah.
I mean, even if you say, all right, these are the 10 vows you're going to take, or the 100 vows you're going to take, you say, I can't do 80.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now you can just sit there and just with the intention of not actually getting the empowerment, which means you're not taking any vows, any commitments. You're just sitting there to kind of practice and see someday maybe you'll do it. That's perfectly acceptable. Yeah, to just go and audit it, so to speak, but not take the exam. Yeah, not for credit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you have a question?
I did, but it was answered.
Okay. Yeah.
The empowerments are to, like, you may take tantric vows to one deity.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then, so if you take more, you're taking it into several.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. The vows are going to be somewhat similar, but the commitments will be very different. Okay. All right. So, let's do another meditation. Any more questions or comments? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's the external refuge, which is the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as we conventionally understand them. But ultimately, what we're really taking refuge in is our own potential to realize the teachings, our inner Dharma, to follow the path, our inner Sangha, and to become a Buddha, our own potential for enlightenment. That is our ultimate source of our ultimate refuge that we go to. They're the external refuge, both the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and their representations as of the statues and the text. But it's ultimately, it's our inner refuge that's most important, is really what it's about. Okay, that's just a way of getting in touch with it. Another commitment that's sometimes mentioned as a refuge commitment, sometimes not, is that every time we see a statue of the Buddha, we should see it as being the actual Buddha. Sometimes that's listed, sometimes it's not. So that's a little bit more esoteric, I think, than the others. Okay, any other questions before we do our final meditation? Okay. Check your posture. And do the 9-round breathing on your own once you've established your posture. And now set your motivation. And now we'll do a couple minutes of just watching the breath, concentration, meditation, to focus the mind, to become a little bit more clear and aware. The object is the physical sensation of breath moving in and out through the nostrils. And now we're going to do an analytic meditation, which means we'll be thinking, but in a very clear and focused manner. We're going to look at the three objects of refuge, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and ask ourselves, is this a valid object of refuge? Do I have confidence in this refuge? And there's no right answer. You can say, no, I don't, because blah, blah, blah. Or, yes, I do, because this, this, this. So stay very clear and focused. If you notice your mind is wandering, come back to the object of analysis. So we'll start with the Buddha. We can use the historical Buddha if we're familiar with his life story. Or if we think there's someone else who was an enlightened being, maybe His Holiness the Dalai Lama or someone like that. And we can say, is this person a valid object of refuge? Not that I'm going to worship them, not that I'm going to bow down to them, but is this person a safe refuge that can help me in my suffering? So begin with the Buddha. What qualities make the Buddha a valid refuge? And now the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, as you've experienced them, your personal experience, are they a refuge that you have confidence in? Do they work? Are they consistent? Do they lead you where you want to go? And lastly, look at the Sangha. Those who are on the path, both the robe Sangha and all the other practitioners, the inner beings, we could call them, are they a valid refuge? Do they possess qualities that you admire or aspire to? Do you feel like their lives are moving in a positive direction? And you can end your meditation with a dedication, dedicating the positive energy that you've created to the benefit of all living beings. A couple, one announcement. There's going to be a change in the schedule for this class. Somehow the schedule, I think, was set up for whoever was supposed to be leading this class, which wasn't me. There are going to be two more classes the next 2 weeks. Originally, for some reason, there was a gap the week of July 4th. See, July 4th is on a Thursday, so there was no class on that Monday. So we're going to meet for two more weeks, and that'll be the end of this class. Okay, two more Monday nights. And the homework is to continue to meditate every day, meditate on the qualities of the objects of refuge, and finish the readings in the syllabus. And we'll see you next week. Okay? Is there going to be a discussion tonight? And there will be a discussion group meeting outside if anyone would like to participate.